Hello, I'm Melissa Idris, and I'm here with Dr. Carl Benedict Frey, who is a Oxford Martin City Fellow at the Oxford University, where he directs a program on the future of work at the Oxford Martin School. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about the future of work, which is your field of research. With every technological revolution, it seems that people have always lost jobs. So what do you think the history, if we look back at history, what do you think, just looking back at history of all the technological revolutions, what can that teach us about the economic anxiety and uncertainty and inequality that we're seeing today?
So a couple of years ago, Mike Osborne and I, we published a study estimating that roughly 47% of American jobs are at risk of being automated. And the study that we've been getting since is, the one you ask is this time different somehow. What can we learn from past experience? And the point I try to make in the book is that we've been through very different periods of technological change in the past, and this time so far looks most similar to the first industrial revolution in Britain, which had very many similar economic features. So this was a time with middle-income jobs disappearing, wages were stagnant or even falling at the bottom end of the income distribution, even as the British economy took off. And it was also a period of not only economic polarization, but also a lot of social and political polarization. And I think there are things that we can learn from that today. Mm. I think there's a tendency, at least in the industrial West, to take technological progress for granted.
We take it for granted, okay.
I think that a lot of people seem to think that it is somehow inevitable.
Mm.
But
it's not.
No, I don't think so, because a lot of history has actually been workers and governments fiercely resisting the introduction of new technologies over fears of job loss and political instability. Mm. And we've already seen a backlash against globalization. And automation so far has had very similar effects.
Okay.
But we've seen nothing yet. As artificial intelligence becomes more pervasive, so will automation and its effects.
All right, okay. So many things that you brought up there that I want to delve into, which I'm hoping we get to do in this interview. But first of all, I want to come back to the fact that you said that this time right now feels very similar to the first industrial revolution. So you talked about the loss of middle income jobs, you about the polarization both politically and, you know, socially. What similarities do you see? Why is it similar to the first industrial revolution in terms of its characteristics, not just in terms of its symptoms, but why is this similar to the first one and not the others?
So I think a lot depends on what type of technology you have, right? And obviously, in many ways, the computer technologies of today are very different from the spinning machines of the Industrial Revolution. But what they have in common is that they are of the replacing sort. So it's, you know, different technologies have different effects. So if you think about a technology like the automatic elevator, right? It replaced the elevator operator. That's very different from the telescope, which, you know, allowed us to do new and inconceivable things. If it anything created new tasks for people, it didn't replace any jobs. And when technologies of the replacing sort, we tend to see many of the trends that we had in recent decades, like stagnant wages, and that was indeed also a feature of the first industrial revolution. Many of these spinning machines replaced artisan workers who earned decent wages. And as a result of that, many of the discontents of the Industrial Revolution also being seen today.
Mm, okay, so it is like a perfect storm. So you have, characteristics like the replacing type of jobs, technology replacing certain types of jobs, and that's very relevant today. So talk to me a little bit about why you said technological progress is not inevitable. It seems to me that it is, because, you know, technology just continues to grow and evolve as we innovate. And that is something that we've been talking about at the Khazanah Megatrends Forum here in terms of our collective brain, right? So
indeed.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, technology comes with what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction, right? So it means that we're creating something new, but in many cases we're also destroying the old. And that is certainly the case if you think about automation technologies, which threatens to replace a lot of jobs. And historically, if you go back sort of to the days of the Roman Empire and even up until sort of the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, governments frequently blocked the introduction of new technologies for fears of a social unrest. The craft guilds had no interest in anything making their jobs and skills redundant, fiercely resisted new technologies. And if technological progress was inevitable, the Industrial Revolution would have happened a bit earlier in the history of mankind. If it was inevitable, every country in the world would have adopted the same technologies to the same extent and would be rich as a consequence.
Sure.
But we're not seeing that.
Okay.
So we're seeing, if anything, divergence in adoption rates.
So in that divergence, are you saying that countries, for instance, if we would just take a look at countries that are technologically advanced, is it because their governments did not limit them in terms of technological innovations? There wasn't so much of a backlash or government stopping this from happening. Is that the differentiation in the divergence?
So I think there are many reasons behind these sort of divergence patterns of technology adoption, but I think that one of them has to do with attitudes towards technological progress and the sort of structure or the balance of political power in society.
Oh.
So in 18th century Britain, wealthy merchants became a class of growing affluence and also growing political power. And their fortunes essentially rested upon mechanization because that was what kept British industry competitive in trade.
Mm.
And the Luddites, who famously smashed machinery, right?
Yes.
They, you know, tried their best to make their voice heard, but property ownership was still a requirement for voting. So that group was essentially politically disenfranchised, and
okay.
mechanization was virtually enforced upon the population. Sometimes workers have a lot of political power, on the other hand. So if you go to a country like Argentina, you will discover that there are not that many railroads you can use and take advantage of. And one reason for that is that the lorry union is very strong.
In
and they
Argentina.
Have no, exactly, and they have no interest of the introduction of railroads in the country. So there's a lot of vested interests which shape patterns of technology adoption. It's not the only driver, but it is certainly a key explanatory fact.
Okay, so the balance of power within societies will explain just how much technology innovation is adopted. All right, we're going to continue this conversation shortly. Make sure you stay tuned to Astro Awani. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Dr. Carl Benedict Frey. We're looking at the future of work. Now, essentially, you mentioned before the break that 47% of jobs will be automated in the future. How far in the future are we talking about?
Right. So we're not saying that 47% of jobs will be automated, because that would be very technologically deterministic. So what we're suggesting is that the potential scope of automation has expanded very rapidly in recent years due to advances in machine learning, subsets of artificial intelligence, mobile robotics, and so on. But the potential scope of automation is quite different from the pace of technology adoption. And
potential scope of automation is different from the pace of adoption.
Right,
okay.
Exactly, right. So from a technological capabilities point of view, a lot of jobs are potentially automatable, but there are a lot of factors beyond technological capabilities that drive decisions to automate, right? So if you go to a country like Japan, you find that Nissan, they're uses a lot of robots in production when they produce cars. When they do the same thing in India, they rely more heavily on cheap labor, so relative cost between capital and labor matter. Even if Google Translate was to become perfect tomorrow, when you want an official document to be translated, it needs to be certified by a translator to be valid.
Right.
So unless we certify Google Translate, it's not going to be adopted on broader scale. And in addition to that, culture and norms matter. So in Japan, robots are already being used in elderly care. In Sweden, where I'm from, there would probably be an outcry if and when that happens.
Okay, so the culture matters too.
I think so, yes.
As you mentioned, the attitudes towards technology, right? So in your line of work, when you have to explain to people about, you know, the rise of the pace of adoption for automation, do you find that the fear of losing jobs, the fear of automation taking over human jobs, is that real? Is the fear real?
I think so, but I think it also diverges across space. So when I go to the US, people seem terrified. When I go home to Sweden, there seems to be a lot less concern. And I think, you know, if you lose your job in Sweden, it's probably less worse than in the US because you don't lose your health insurance with it, for example. So there are some geographical differences, but there is also a lot of anxiety about automation. And one of the sort of key things that struck me when researching the book is that how much technology has progressed over the centuries, but how little the debate surrounding its effects has actually progressed. So we have these sort of periods of automation anxiety over and over again, and
right.
This time as well, it's very real.
So what do you mean that the debates have not progressed? Are there gaps in the way we're talking about it? Are we not thinking about the effects of automation correctly?
Yes, I think so in part, but I think, I mean, there are two sort of ways of seeing it. So, I mean, there's overall welfare sort of society perspective in which, you know, societies grow wealthier by adopting those technologies, right?
Sure.
Some people individually is not going to be better off due to technology adoption, and we see that particularly in manufacturing industry. Cities that have deindustrialized, either because of globalization or automation, have seen sort of persistent increases in joblessness and a lot of sort of bad social consequences associated with
right.
that. So increases in crime, increases in suicide rates, deteriorating public services, faltering marriage rates. And you know, economists tend to think that the purpose of production is consumption, but people actually, you know, put a lot of meaning to their work. So I think that sort of the individual consequences from automation and the anxiety surrounding that is very real for many people.
Sure. All right. So let's talk about, I guess, looking at how automation and machine learning will threaten jobs of the future. So robots perhaps taking over manual work, artificial intelligence perhaps taking over certain jobs that previously required a brain. So what is then left for human work? Where do you see the role of humans? You mentioned, you know, Google Translate, someone, I guess, checking that document once again, verifying that document. But what's left for human work then, if we take into account the adoption of all these technological automations?
So there are several domains in which machines still perform very poorly. One is complex social interactions, right? And I think the state of the art there is best described by Turing test competitions, where chatbots try to convince human judges of them being a person.
Yes.
And some people have argued that was a breakthrough 3 years ago when one chatbot managed to convince 30% of judges of it being a person. But it did so by pretending to be a 13-year-old Russian orphan boy speaking English as his second language with no understanding of English culture. And if you think about the variety of much more complex social interactions that we do in our daily jobs, mm-hmm. we try to motivate the people around us, we try to persuade people that we're right, and so on and so forth, it's almost inconceivable that we will see machines outperforming us in those domains. I think the same goes for creativity. So the people argue, and there's a big debate about this in
yes.
the machine learning community, whether machines can be creative. And maybe sometimes they will, but I think they're very far from being creative. I think most people that argue that machines are creative today conflate novelty with creativity. So I could draw something here on the table and call myself an artist, but few people would be likely to buy it. And I think the challenging part is to create something that's novel that also makes sense.
Okay, all right. So I guess jobs with creativity, jobs that require I guess human interaction will be work of the future, but that is very limited, right? So do you think there will be new roles opening up roles that we haven't even considered in the past.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you were to go back to 1900 and ask your great grandparents, right, what do you think that, you know,
jobs future, of the future generations will be like?
They wouldn't say, you know, my son is probably going to be a hot yoga instructor. My daughter is going to be a software engineer, right? And I think
in drone similar, operator.
Exactly, artificial intelligence auditor. So I think that we are similarly ill placed to sort of. Conceive what the jobs of the future will be. It's, you know, a lot easier to predict what chunk of current jobs are potentially automatable than seeing the jobs
Understood.
Of the future.
Understood. All right, after this, we're going to come back and take a look at the role of education in preparing for ourselves for work of the future. Stay tuned to Astro Wani. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Dr. Carl Benedict Frey from Oxford University. We're talking about work of the future, and I think I want to know what the role of education will be. I think it could be completely different from the way we approach education right now if we want to future-proof our children. So what do you think the role of schools specifically will be in preparing for jobs of the future?
Well, education in schools have always played a critical role in allowing people to adjust to technology shocks, right? Mm-hmm. So when the tractor arrived, for example, farmers realized that for the children to prosper in the age of the industrial, in the age of tractors, they would need to invest more in education. And the high school movement was a consequence of that, which allowed people to go to school and to take on better paid office jobs. So similarly, this time around, education is going to play a key role. But I think we need to think differently about education, because I think it's more likely that we're going to have many different jobs throughout a lifespan today. And as a result of that, I think we need to be able to learn also in parallel to our jobs. And it doesn't make much sense to me that, you know, you enter, at Oxford University where I teach, you enter, if you take a bachelor course or a degree, you study for 3 years, and what you learned at the end of that period varies greatly.
Right.
It would make a lot more sense to make the period of learning variable and the learning targets fixed. So some people can learn it within 6 months, potentially. Some people may need longer. But I think we need to personalize and modularize education in a way that, you know, increases flexibility and allows people to also learn and sort of on the side of working.
Well, so the nature of formal education could change greatly in the future, in responding to the way, to technological changes, to automation in jobs. So we might not be seeing, you know, the typical formal learning in classrooms the way that we're seeing today.
Well, I think some formal schooling is still going to be required. But I do think in higher education, we do have to change towards more modular approaches. I think the curricula in schools will probably to some extent have to change as well. So the more data-driven a lot of industries and jobs become, the more we will need people to have, you know, statistical knowledge, skills in working with data, and so on. So I think that is part of how the curriculum needs to change. But I'm not of the view that we need to rethink education
okay.
from scratch. I think, you know, a lot
maybe
of
tweak the current system as is. So. On that note, I mean, this could be simplifying matters a bit too much, but you mentioned statistical knowledge, right? So what kind of skills do we need to be learning to make sure that we're still relevant in the future? And, you know, not just for young people, new graduates coming out of university, but also people who have been in the workforce facing these changes, learning to adapt to technological innovations. What kind of skills will we need?
Well, so speaking from my own experience in Oxford, so we struggled to keep, you know, our PhDs who do information engineering and machine learning for the full PhD, because they get great job offers and are hired by Facebook and Google and, you know, write their own code and sell off their own.
They're pinching all the best brains, aren't they?
Indeed, very much so. That being said, though, it's not just about technical skills. So you want to focus on things in which machines perform poorly, and that is also social and creative skills, and that is much broader skill set than only sort of the technical machine learning skills you get if you study engineering.
Making sure that the creative, the artistic side is not left behind in, you know, statistics and data learning and being very technical as well. If I could come back very quickly, Carl, to something you said a bit earlier. You talked a little bit about countries, the backlash against technology, and, you know, the countries' attitudes towards technological innovations are important in the way they progress. So what can developing countries, such as Malaysia, learn about, learn from history and perhaps from your research in order to catch up in the age of automation?
So the way that countries grew rich in the past was simply by industrializing, right? Shifting labor from low productivity working agriculture to more productive jobs in manufacturing. Mm. And I think that there is still some window of opportunity for emerging economies to do that today. But I do think that there is a worry whether countries will be able to do that looking forward. So even in China, manufacturing employment has already peaked and 12 million manufacturing jobs have been shredded since 2013, in part because of production moving further on to low cost destinations, but also because China has become the largest market for industrial robots in the world. And so I think what developing countries can learn from this is, if you look to advanced economies, most job creation centers on the labor multiplier. So new jobs being created in technology industries and creative industries and professional type of services, those jobs in turn, so if you create a tech job in the city of Kuala Lumpur, that person goes out in the local service economy, goes to the hairdresser, goes grocery shopping, takes a taxi, that creates on balance 5 new jobs in the local service
economy. Multiply effect.
Indeed, exactly. So I think lots of future job creation will depend on this labor multiplier and actually moving relatively early to more sort of value-added type of services.
Okay, so in that way, that would require, that will help grow the economy. So we're looking at making sure that there is a certain multiplier effect. What does technology, what does history teach us about technology adoption and inequality? Because that is something technology is said to be, you know, democratizing, but is that really, does that create more inequality in society more than we're seeing now today?
Well, the question has to do with the short run versus the long run, right? So if you look at the Industrial Revolution, it created a lot of inequality in its early stages. It replaced a lot of middle-income jobs in domestic industry. During the later stages, when technology became more augmenting and people acquired new skills, their outside options became more plentiful and they had more bargaining power, and more people benefited from the industrialization process. But the short run can be a long time. During the Industrial Revolution, it was 7 decades. More recently, American men with no more than a high school degree have seen their wages fall for 4 decades now. And they are seeing their employment prospects worsening in the labor market. But that is not to suggest that that process is going to continue indefinitely.
Okay, so it really is the time frame that you're looking at. In the last couple of minutes that we have left, can you share a little bit about what you presented today at the Khazanah Megatrends Forum? Just how you know, all this relates back to the collective brain, which is essentially the theme of the conference.
Indeed. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, so what you see in the short run is that a lot of people that are replaced can be made worse off individually in the short run. And if people are made worse off, they also have an incentive to resist the technology. But because technology is the main driver of economic growth over the long run, we have a collective interest in making sure that those individual costs are not leading to slower technology adoption and even a backlash against technology itself. So the sort of collective brains matters in terms of actually trying to solve this problem.
Okay, making sure that also everyone has equal access to this collective brain, right?
Indeed.
All right, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
My pleasure.
I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for Astro Awani. I'll catch you next time. Thanks for watching. We'll be right back.